Hello and welcome to Launch. We're broadcasting live from Atlanta, Georgia. I'm your host, Ron Reardon, and I'm joined in the studio by a producer, Lee Kanner. Good morning, Lee. How are you doing today?
Good morning, Ron. How about you in this fine, fine spring day?
Yeah, I'm doing fine. I'm keep waiting for the pollen to decrease.
I know. When's that going to happen? You know all this stuff.
Well, they say don't wash your car for another week or two.
Really? Because mine's pretty nasty.
Yeah, but it's good for maybe 5 minutes, and then it gets covered with the pollen again.
I know. It's brutal.
I heard something like 200 and something is really bad on the pollen count,
right?
And we're at 3,000 or something like that.
Now, when I moved here, I moved from Miami, Florida, and there was never. I never saw pollen. I didn't even know what it was like for the first few years of living here.
What's that yellow stuff?
I have no idea what this is.
You thought maybe there was a factory that was creating yellow stuff?
Tennis balls. I thought it was tennis balls.
Tennis balls. Okay. Well, Lee, on Launch, we feature inventors, innovators, entrepreneurs, providing our listeners with the opportunity to learn from successes and failures of launching an idea and the journey that follows. This morning, we're featuring Michael Horton of Horton CC, but before we get started, Lee, could you thank today's sponsor?
Sure. Our sponsor today is Patents & More. Patents & More, protecting your innovation and connecting you to the resources you need for success.
Okay. Michael Horton of Horton CC is going to be our guest today, and it would take, I think, the rest of our program to read his bio, because he is a true renaissance man.
He's done a lot, huh?
He has done a lot. He could do this interview with either English, Danish, French, German, Norwegian, and Swedish. He speaks all those languages.
Wow.
But he's a European-educated lawyer with over 35 years' experience as a practicing attorney. And he's been here in Atlanta for 25 years. He was with King & Spalding. But at the end of 1999, he retired from there to launch Horton CC, which is a legal practice that focuses on the needs of small to medium-sized companies, with particular emphasis on emerging growth companies. So, Michael, welcome to the show.
Oh, I'm glad to be on your show.
Okay. Well, you do a lot of things, but what does the CC stand for in Horton CC?
It stands for Corporate Counsel.
Corporate Council. Okay, I was kind of curious as to what that was.
You stood for Country Club, didn't you?
Country Club, yeah. Okay, it could be a lot of different things. Well, when we talk to entrepreneurs and inventors, the subject that always comes up is money. They don't have it, and they need it. Could you talk to us a little bit about the venture financing strategy?
Yeah, and that's unfortunately where I see a lot of young companies fail, because they're just not applying the right strategy, and that's particularly important in today's environment, which is, as you well know, it's a very difficult environment in which to raise money. And there are a couple of I would say of key considerations that apply to raising money. First, and that has nothing to do with today's environment. Obviously, the whole name of the game is to raise money in tranches. If you know, for example, that you need $10 million to basically get to the goal line, you could not start by raising $10 million, because you would obviously, you had so little value at the company at that time that you would be diluted down to virtually no interest in the company. So the strategy is to always raise raise it in installments, and the idea is that each installment would basically catapult the valuation of the company way beyond the money that you raised. So if you raised the first tranche, let's say, of $100,000, and that gets you to the next milepost that kicks up the valuation, then the idea is that at that time the valuation of the company would have gone up by far more than the $100,000 that you received from the investors. And of course, that means if you raise money, for example, at $1 a share in the first round, then perhaps in the next round you can raise it at $2 a share, which means that you suffer less dilution. So that's one is one kind of golden rule, is to do it in tranches and tie those tranches to the milepost, to something that would kick up the valuation of the company. And then I always tell my clients to, in addition to that, you should raise a sufficient amount of money so that you have 5 to 6 months of run rate after that, because you can obviously only start the new capital raise once you have achieved that milepost. And then to be on the safe side, you should allow yourself 5 to 6 months to, you know, get the next round of financing. Because if the investor sense that you're about to run out of money, then it's very difficult to get good terms.
Yeah, I can imagine that. So it's I guess it's just baby steps. It's kind of, to use a baseball analogy, instead of going for the home run, it's like, let's get the first base, you know.
Exactly. Okay. That's a very good analogy. It's a very good analogy. The other thing that I think where a number of companies fail in terms of setting the strategy is that, you know, they have to kind of realize where is the money coming from. And, you know, typically the first initial round would come from friends and family. Perhaps the next round would be coming from angel investors. And then you may have institutional rounds from venture capital funds, et cetera. And what has happened here over the last 10 years is that the venture capital funds have become so large that when they deploy their money and do the due diligence and basically monitor the companies in which they have invested, they want to be able to deploy a large sum of money. And I remember statistics I saw, I think, a couple of years ago that shows that the average venture capital round, I think it was in 1998, was $7 million. In 2008, it was $14 million. Mm-hmm. So generally speaking, the venture capital firms don't invest as early stage as they used to. And yet angels, if you have an angel round, angels continue to invest at about, 50,000 is probably the average what an angel invests in a particular round, maybe 25,000, maybe go as high as, 100,000 and above, but the average is probably still around $50,000. And I say a good angel round should not be in excess of 2 million, preferably not more than 1.5 million. So you have this gap, as I say, where the angels, you're beyond the capacity of angels, and you're not yet within the realm of the venture capital firm. So you have to kind of, and that's kind of from $2 to $5 million. So you have to also plan your round so that you don't fall into what I call no man's land. So those are some of some basic strategies that should be deployed in any environment.
Now, when a person is thinking about doing this, there was a time, in the .com era early on where people were getting funding on ideas on a napkin. Obviously those times are past. Mm-hmm. Now, is it totally necessary to kind of work with somebody like you that can guide an entrepreneur through this process, or is this something that an entrepreneur can kind of figure out as they go?
I mean that they can raise the capital without the involvement of a lawyer?
Right. Is this something an entrepreneur can do on their own, or they need outside counsel?
Nope. No, and the reason being is in this country, the raising of money is heavily regulated under federal and state security laws, and particularly for these type of companies. And this is unfortunately what I've seen on a number of occasions. Is, I mean, if this were kind of a mom and pop operation that was never going to hyper grow the business through successive rounds of outside capital, that's one thing. But in this case, if you don't do it right in the initial rounds, you may have prevented yourself from getting money in later rounds, because the institution investor, when they do their due diligence, they realize that you didn't comply with the securities laws in the first round, and therefore they just don't want to touch you.
Yeah. So what I heard you saying, Michael, is that the kind of the stages that an entrepreneur would go through is first they look at the mirror and they see their first funding source. So it's the it's the person that starts the business, and then they go to family, and then after family, friends, and then after you've exhausted your own personal resources and your family and friends, then it's time for the angels, and then after the angels, it's the venture capitalist.
Right. I have a very hard time hearing you. I hear Lee very well, but Ron, you were kind of very faint.
Okay, well, we'll get it cranked up.
I think what I heard you said is kind of what are the sources, and I think you're right. Obviously, initially, the founders kind of tried to fund as much of it themselves and probably exhausting their credit cards. And then before you really have much of a product, you probably will go to friends and family, which are really kind of, they're investing in you. There's really not enough of substance there, but they have a relationship to you of some sort, and they know if you are involved, you probably, I mean, they've worked with you in the past, they believe in you, so they're really investing in you. And then you get to the next step up typically is you may have exhausted kind of the capacity of family and friends, and you then go to, you know, to angels, you know, for the next round. And I say an angel round is usually between 500,000 to 1.5 million. And then, you know, you, thereafter it can be, if you need money thereafter, it could be venture capital funds, strategic investors, or maybe a customer that, you know, invests in the, in your prospective customer that invests in your company.
Okay. Well, you know, I've talked to some entrepreneurs that seem to be kind of unrealistic about the time frames and the amounts. I know that if you're talking to your wealthy Uncle Joe, you know, he might write you a check on the spot. But what's the, usually the time frames and the amounts for an angel investor and for a venture capitalist?
Yeah, as I say, you know, the angel investor, the individual angel investor, would typically invest, you know, I've not seen any statistics on this, but I would imagine, you know, that it's probably around $50,000, you know, a very typical amount for angel is, you know, $25,000, $50,000. That's a very typical amount for an angel to invest. And as I say, in the aggregate, because it is tough to get, you know, more than, you know, a couple of million dollars from angel investors. I mean, obviously there are exceptions to that, but that's kind of the, I mean, a good rule of thumb. It just gets so difficult. You have to talk to a lot of $50,000 investors to get to, you know, to that amount. Plus, you end up with a lot of shareholders in the company.
Right.
What do you have to give up to get $50,000 typically? What percentage of the company?
That is impossible to say in the abstract. I mean, that goes to the whole issue of, you know, of valuation of the company. You know, if obviously what you have to give up depends on, you know, the value that you put on the company or that the investor puts on the company. So, I mean, if you're raising $1 million and you think you have a company that has a valuation of $2 million, then you would give up one third. Because once the investor has invested $1 million, you have a $3 million company and he has one third of it. If you think you have a $3 million company and are raising $1 million, then you would have to give up 25%.
But who decides the valuation?
This is another thing where I see a lot of companies failing. Because if it is, for example, if it's a venture capital investment, then typically what they would do, I mean, they always do this, they would basically come up with a term sheet in which they would basically propose a valuation as well as proposing the terms of the type of securities and the terms of those securities that they want to receive in return for their investment. And then that may be negotiated a little bit with the investor. If you're talking about an angel round, then by far most angel money is raised from individuals. You just go from individual to individual. There are formalized angel groups that basically will act as miniature venture capital fund. For example, I'm a member of something called the Atlanta Technology Angels, and I really think of us as being almost a small venture capital fund, although we are not a fund, but we do operate in the same way that we would present the term sheet to the company in which we would, you know, obviously set the valuation and the terms of our investment in the company. But that's really the exception, because by far the most amount of angel money is raised just from individual to individual. And there, it's a very different process. Because in that process, the company has to basically put a value, the value on the founders have to put a value on the company, because you cannot negotiate with 10, 15 different angels. You can't negotiate. And the angels, by the way, they typically don't know. They're not investment bankers. I mean, they may be professionals, may be executives, but they're certainly not investment bankers. So they may not really have the facility to put a value on the company. But the company, the founders have to put a value on the company. And then, very importantly, they have to stick with that value, because under the securities laws, you cannot offer one value to one investor, another value to another investor. I mean, it's not like it's not like selling ice cream, where in the morning when it's cold you have to sell it $1, then when it heats up you can sell it $1.25. I mean, everybody in this round has to get the same valuation, the same terms. And that means that you can't negotiate with a $50,000 investor and then negotiate with another. You just have to come out with terms, stick with them, and those terms have to be terms that resonate in the marketplace, because you really don't have a second chance. And it's not the best analogy I can give up. That's something I often tell people who have not done this before, but a lot of people have bought and sold, you know, their home. And if you misjudge the market, which a lot of people certainly do in Atlanta, and I suspect in Florida too, Lee, where you are from, is they do not realize that the real estate prices have really dropped. You have a second chance. I mean, you see that when you drive around the neighborhood. You see these for sale signs that have a stick on them that says recently reduced or something like that. After they've been on the market for, you know, a couple of months with no traffic, no offers. And then eventually, you know, the owners end up selling it. In this is very different, because if you put the wrong, and I had an example here last summer when I basically listened to an angel presentation by a company that presented to an angel group that I'm a member of, a company from New Mexico. It was in June of last year, and they basically, I liked what they were doing, I liked the management team, but I thought it was way too pricey. And I declined. And then I suddenly got a call in August from the CEO, and I had forgotten all about the company, and said, "Michael, I have good news for you. Do you remember we were selling shares at $1 a share in June? Now they're 50 cents a share."
That's good news.
I had no
it's on sale.
What?
It's on sale. You can
yeah. but see, it's not like a home, because number one, and I'm a typical angel, I'm also an angel investor in addition to be a lawyer, my reaction is very typical. First of all, I had moved on to something else. I'd forgotten all about the company, so he kind of lost the opportunity when he was telling me about the company. I got all excited, was reviewing the executive summary and so forth. So he lost that initial excitement. But more importantly, I don't know why he didn't get all the money. He had gotten $500,000 out of $1.5 million. I don't know why he hadn't gotten all the money. It could have been because people thought it was too pricey. It could have been because people didn't like the business plan, didn't like the company's business, or maybe they didn't think that the company could execute on their vision. And I declined. And it's not like when you see a house that's listed in June for $500,000, and then you drive by it in August and see $250,000. I mean, you know that that's a good deal. In this business, you just don't know. And so I declined, and I'm sure, you know, anybody else would have been approached in that first round declined as well. So I always tell my clients to be sure to price it so that it resonates in today's marketplace, because you really only have one shot at a particular investor. You can't come back, generally speaking, and with a lower price, you know, a month or two later. And, of course, with this company in New Mexico, what they had to do is then they would have had to gone back to their the folks who invested at $1 a share and issue the double amount of shares, because, again, as I said earlier, everybody in that round has to get the same price.
When you have a round that, you, like you just mentioned, say in this example, you're trying to raise $1 million in the first round, and say you do accumulate $500,000 and then you're having trouble to move on, do you have that? Do you actually have access to those funds, or do you have to wait until you get the full million before you can access those funds?
This is another way you structure, and I'll go back to the valuation issue in a moment, but first address this question. This is another way you try to make, you know, when I represent companies that are, you know, raising money, which I do an awful lot of, you know, basically we prepare a term sheet or a private placement memorandum, and we try to come up with terms, as I say, that we think will be, we don't want to give the company away, but a company that with terms that basically seem to be in line with today's market conditions. And one of the things that you often do in an early round to make it attractive is, because if I'm approached for, let's say that you're hypothetical where companies are seeking to raise a million, one of the concerns I'm going to have, what if I'm the only one? What if I invest 50,000? What if I'm the only one? I mean, then the company is, there's no way the company can get to the goal. And it's kind of like putting money down the toilet. So that makes me very hesitant to invest. So that what you often do in a term sheet is what the company says, we will basically, and maybe it's not a million, maybe it's $500,000, maybe it's 600,000, but at some point where you say we can't get to that next milepost, but we can get to somewhere. We can get to somewhere that kicks up the valuation. I mean, we can get somewhere, and if that's 500,000, and then what the company will say is we will basically escrow the money. We'll put the money into a separate account until we have accumulated 500,000 or whatever that amount is. And then if we don't get to that amount, we will return you your money. And see, in that way, you don't have, as an investor, you're not so concerned about being the first one out of the starting block because you know the company cannot use your $50,000 until it has gotten, you know, money from other investors.
And that really lowers the perception of risk from their standpoint.
Excuse me, I couldn't hear you.
I said that really lowers the risk perception from their standpoint.
See, that's what you try to mean. You try to make it, you know, I mean, attractive to the investors. I mean, and that's, I mean, in the term sheet, I mean, you would basically address kind of, you know, the obviously the terms of the kind of securities you issue, common, preferred, what have you, but also the terms of the offering, and that's one of the terms of the offering. You say, you know, we need to get to this overall minimum before we can use the money.
Right.
Another term you would say is, you know, you put an end to the offering period, because if I'm putting $50,000 today into the company, I mean, it would be a little bit upsetting to me if somebody could invest a year from now and get the same terms for their $50,000. So you basically also say the offering usually, it's going to close. I mean, we won't keep it open forever.
Yeah, I like your analogy of the house, but I also like another analogy. It seems like working with angel investors, it's a lot like dating. And, you know, expecting an angel investor to write you a $50,000 check at the first meeting is, you know, being very unrealistic, that you're really going to have to develop a relationship.
Yeah. Absolutely. I mean, absolutely. And you also have, there are also security laws issues here, because you can't do public solicitation. And basically, to be really safe on the security law issue, under security laws, you really should only solicit people with whom you have a pre-established relationship.
Now, Michael, can you talk a little bit about what when you deal with an entrepreneur, they're obviously coming to you at a very early stage in their business. What can you walk us through what those initial conversations are like? And like, do you have at first, is there a fee to just even talk to you about this, or how does it work?
No. I mean, I never charge for an initial solicitation, and I think most lawyers don't. but what we have, and as I think certainly Ron knows, is we have developed a model, a fee model that I think is unique in the country. I've never heard of anybody who has this model. And it's basically we do everything for a fixed fee. If you know, and certainly Ron knows this, lawyers generally work by the hour. And that's something that makes these young companies very, very apprehensive, because, you know, they feel the same way I feel when I take my car to mechanics to have the radiator fixed. I don't know whether it's supposed to take the mechanic an hour or 5 hours, and that's the way they feel about attorneys. And it's not like in my former life when I dealt with large publicly owned companies, and they always had huge in-house legal staff. And when an in-house lawyer engages outside counsel, he's a sophisticated purchaser of legal services. He has an idea what it's going to cost, but these companies have no idea of what it would take, and they're very hesitant because they know every time to call and the attorney, because every time they call, they know the attorney keeps track of every 6 minutes and they get billed by an hourly rate. So what we do is we do everything for a fixed fee, and that has been extremely well received. And it sounds easy, but it's not always, because a lot of what we do are negotiated transactions, and I have no control over how many rounds of negotiations and how many drafts, but we still do it because it sets us apart. And on the average, you know, I mean, one deal we may not do well, but then we do really well on another deal. On the average, you know, we do fine, and we got much better in setting our fees. But what I do when I meet with a client who is trying to seek money, I basically walk them through the process. And then also what I see oftentimes is that they are not, you need to have conceptually, you need to have a company that's financeable. It's not enough just to have, you know, incorporated. And of course that happens a lot of times. They have just established the LLC or established the corporation, but they haven't, and that's really just the tip of the iceberg. I mean, you need to have the relationship among the founders need to have been documented. And I mean, for example, I had a situation here a couple of years ago when I was helping a young ATDC company, you know, that's the Advanced Technology Development Center here in Atlanta, one of their companies, with their first capital raise. And there were two founders. They'd been together for, you know, almost 2.5 years. And I said, you know, they didn't have a shareholders agreement. They had never really formalized their relationship. And I say, you need to do that before you can go out and raise money. And it turned out, unfortunately, that they were not completely on the same page. And it took them about 3 months to finally, you know, work out their relationship. And then 8 months thereafter, one of the founders, totally unrelated to their business, committed suicide in San Francisco. And had they not had that founders agreement or shareholders agreement, whatever you want to call it, then, you know, the deceased founder's mother would have been, you know, the surviving partner's new partner.
Right.
And that's just one. And the other thing that founders often fail to do is, because founders typically wear two hats. I mean, they're co-owners of the business, but also they work in the business, and generally they work for very little or no money in the beginning.
Right.
And for example, if you have a situation where you have, you know, two founders, and you know, they say that they have, you know, that they have, you know, they get they had a million shares each, and they're expected to basically work for free for a period of time. Then you could have a real difficult situation, because let's say that one of them he basically suddenly gets an offer from Google to work for $1 million a year, and he says, this is the dream offer I've been waiting for all my life. I'm out of here. In that case, he would still have his million shares, still have 50% of it. And what the company would need to do, they would need to find a replacement for this founder in his working capacity. And the only way typically a company can find somebody, since they have no money to pay that person, is they would issue him additional stock, right? So let's say that they issue an additional 500,000 shares to get that new executive. on board to replace, you know, the founder who is now working with Google, then suddenly the non-terminated founder's shares have been reduced. He has been reduced to a 40% stake in the company.
Right. So he lost both ways. He has to do more work, and he has less equity.
No, no, because assuming in my example, he got somebody who took over the work.
Right.
But the only way they could do that was to issue additional shares.
Right, to dilute his shares.
Yeah. So, yeah, so instead of being 2 million shares outstanding, we had, in my example, 2.5 million shares
right.
outstanding.
Okay.
And so what you deal with, the way you deal with that is what's referred to as reverse vesting. So the founders would agree in their founders' agreement, they would agree that, you know, they hadn't fully earned their million shares. And if they were to leave kind of prematurely, and usually I look at that in terms of when is it that we expect that they can get their full salary. And then in this case, given they say he had vested that to, if everything worked as it's supposed to, they say that he had $500,000 of his shares had vested, but the $500,000 that had not vested, that basically would revert to the company, would lost, and then they would reissue those to the new executive coming on board. So it's just another example of something that I see very often the founders not dealing with is their relationship as working for the company.
Yeah, and at the beginning is the best time to define that.
Very much down kind of Ron's alley is you also need to make sure, and I often see that that's not the case, is that, you know, the founders may have formed a company, you know, kind of, you know, once they get a little bit down the line, and yet they haven't formally contributed the intellectual property that they have developed to the company. I mean, that needs obviously to be done. There needs to be a formal assignment of the intellectual property to the company. And then the founders, as well as any executive and employee you know, working for the company, needs to sign a kind of what I call a restrictive covenants agreement, which has provisions like, you know, any refinement and further intellectual property being developed is what we lawyers call work for hire. It belongs to the company, that they will not compete with the company, that they will keep the company's confidential information, they will keep it confidential and only use it for the purpose of the company's business. I mean, all of these things, that these are just, you know, samples of things that need to be done before you accept outside money.
Yeah, it's really important to...
All of this is done to... It also protects the founders, but it also protects the investors.
Yeah, it's really important to get all the I's dotted and T's crossed. Well, Michael, when you look at, you know, high-tech, low-tech, and idea on a napkin to a growth company, what's the profile of a perfect client for you?
You know, for me, I'm pretty much agnostic when it comes to, you know, to clients. I mean, it doesn't really matter what industry. I mean, I think kind of, you know, our sweet spot are basically what I call entrepreneurial growth companies. By that, I mean companies that are not trying to establish, and we represent those too, but I say we really like representing the companies that are not aiming at becoming a lifestyle business, but companies that are trying to accelerate or hyper-grow the business through use of outside capital.
Okay.
Now, is this something, when a firm works with you, is there times, like you had mentioned, you're an angel investor as well, do you sometimes, you know, participate with those companies?
Yes. I mean, of course, I mean, I really have a very unique opportunity, you know, through my practice, in that I, you know, I get to work with these young companies, and you know, I feel I'm a much better in position to make an informed investment decision when I work with a company. I know, of course, that their legal affairs, if they're clients of mine, I know that their legal affairs are in order. I have a good feel for the management team, which is so important for any investment decision, and also get a good feel for how, I mean, the company, the product seem to be faring in the marketplace. And what I do, you know, quite often, I say, okay, instead of paying me in cash, why don't you issue me some warrants? And I've done that quite a bit. I have companies coming to me and say, would I do it from day one? And I generally don't do that, because then it's like making an investment decision kind of blindfolded, you know.
Right.
So I always say they have to be a client. And then, you know, and once I get to know them, I'm happy to just take warrants instead of cash.
But when you work with them, say on a transactional basis where you're just, you know, they're paying your fixed fee, is this something that you kind of give them guidance, like, you know what, you would, another founder might be a good move for you here, or maybe you need somebody in this kind of capacity to help you grow? Do you help them in, you
right
know?
And this is something that I say I really enjoy about my, because I say my, I describe myself as a recovering big firm attorney, because I spent most of my life with very large firms and working with very large publicly owned companies. And what I enjoy about these young companies is, number one, you know, they don't have in-house counsel. So it's not like if I deal with a Coca-Cola company, I mean, I always have to, although I deal directly with the executives too, but I always have to kind of make sure I make the in-house lawyer shine, that I make sure that, you know, that he is my principal client, and he may sometimes say, no, this is great advice, now I'm going to take it to the Fountain Sales Division or whatever. There is not this legal filter on the client side, which to me is very satisfying. And then because we have the fixed fee model, you know, they don't hesitate to call us. So I'm very close to my clients. I know a lot about their business, a lot about their business aspirations. And because I've done so many deals over my years of practice, I mean, a lot of my advice is non-legal. I mean, it's just practical advice. And I think, for example, when it comes to raising capital, probably one of the biggest value that I bring to my clients is not so much the knowledge of the security laws, et cetera, but really the knowledge of the today's deal terms. And I kind of analogize it to go to back to kind of house analogy. I mean, if you were to sell a house, and the first thing you need to do is you need to put a price on the house, and you probably would be well advised to get a real estate agent that really knows your neighborhood and maybe does one or two sales in your neighborhood a year, rather than going to somebody who maybe does one a year in your neighborhood. And that's, I do so many of these early stage financing that I feel I have my finger on the pulse, and therefore can tell them. I think that's the greatest value I bring to my clients, is I kind of can help them structure terms that will be well received in the marketplace. And it's not only because I do so many, but also because I'm active in a number of angel groups, so I see companies getting funded in which, you know, that where I'm not representing either the investor or the company, so I see those and being funded and see the terms under which they get funded.
Well, Michael, you mentioned how important the management team is. Do you ever get involved with getting the right management brought into a company that you're looking at?
Yeah. I mean, I do, and I keep on my computer, keep a list of, you know, of executives. I mean, people there, and there are a number of, first of all, there are a number of serial entrepreneurs that have kind of taken the company to an exit event, and then, you know, they want to get involved and roll up their sleeves again. There are also a number of executives retired from large companies that basically get tired of sitting in the rocking chair and basically want to, you know, get involved with a young, dynamic company. And then, for example, I just had a situation here where I put with a client of mine, and it's an executive with a large, it's called Ahold. I don't know if you know, it's a big, it's actually Dutch-based, but they have about 40,000 employees in the U.S. They have several chains of supermarkets in the U.S., and he retired, you know, a couple of years ago, and he played a lot of golf, and he had said to me, you know, I really would like to do something, and I've now gotten him involved with he's now the chairman of the board of a very active chairman of the board in a little company that basically has created a new carpet cleaning fluid and a new kind of service contract which doesn't exist in this industry. And that's been extremely helpful to the founder, because not only has this guy lots of expertise, but basically the first round, which was $800,000, basically came from him and his friends. So that's the kind of ideal situation where you can get, you know, and with somebody who not only brings money, but also, you know, brings talent.
Yeah. Well, Michael, you know, your access to that talent is a real value add for entrepreneurs. Really, thank you for being.
Oh, I mean, it's so important, and sometimes, and that's unfortunate, you know, entrepreneurs who have been toiling with their, you know, idea and their project for years and burned out their credit cards, it's very hard for them to let go. And you know, the example I always give is, which everybody knows here in Atlanta, is, you know, ISS is a good example, Internet Security System, which was started by a young, you know, Georgia Tech student, Chris Klaus. And he basically gave, I think it was about 50% away of the company to a very, very, you know, I forget what he was, with McKinsey or company or Boston Consulting Group, but a very smart MBA type, Tom Noonan. And you know, they had, a couple of years ago, a $400 million exit event. And I always tell founders it's much better to have a small stake a $400 million company than having 100% of a $10 million company.
Okay, that's great. Well, how can our radio listeners get in touch with you, Michael?
Oh, man, they can reach me at my email address is mhorten, and Horton is spelled H-O-R-T-E-N, at HortonCC. Again, that's charliecharlie.com. So mhorten at HortonCC.com. And my telephone number is 770-436-7834.
Okay, well, thanks for being on our show today, Michael. Our listeners have gotten...
Oh, it was my pleasure.
They've gotten some really great nuggets and learnings that they can really use in their launch and their journey. Thanks again.
Thanks.
It was my pleasure. Okay.
All right, bye.
Another great show, Lee.
Bye-bye.
Yes, Ron, that was awesome.
And tune in each week at the same time to listen live, or go to our website at thelaunchhour.businessradiox.com to listen at your convenience. Until next week, I'm Ron Reardon with our producer, Lee Cantor, signing off another great session of Launch.